Good morning and welcome to Shattering Myths, a program devoted to those of you who know that there's something dreadfully wrong with the political and religious institutions which govern and influence our nation, who recognize the considerable malfeasance inherent in the media, in the military, especially on this Veterans Day, and with global economic influences. We realize that these institutions are the problem, which means that they cannot be part of the solution. Therefore, our mission is to look behind the headlines so that we know who is perpetrating the tragedies that are besieging our planet. Because based upon this plague of adverse political, religious, military, and economic influences, we have at most 15 years until all hell is unleashed. A complete economic collapse, world war, unrelenting propaganda to which most will submit, and the deaths of billions. As a result, in our second hour, we're going to engage God on His terms through evidence and reason, since His guidance regarding His covenant provides the only hope of escape from any of this. Our phone number, if you'd like to participate in this discussion, it's toll-free. It's 877-300-7645. Today is called a salute to service. Even in the arena of sports yesterday and today, it cannot be ignored everywhere you turn. Even the private sector is playing the propaganda game and trying to pretend as if military service was service. Now, before I consider and share with you the various wars that America has fought, and also share with you the warning that our founding father, the most intellectual American probably to ever live, Thomas Jefferson, wrote regarding the standing army, I would like to begin by defining the noun service. It's called military service, a salute to service. We are paying tribute to those who serve. Well, service is the action of helping or doing work for someone. There is no one in the military that's helping me. How about you? How about doing work for you? Is your work killing and destroying? The quote definition is explained in the sentence, millions are involved in voluntary service. Well, yes, the military is voluntary, but it's a job. You're paid to learn how to kill and destroy. That is what you're paid to do should you volunteer for that job. Service is further defined by the following synonyms according to the online definitions. Favor, kindness, good turn, helping hand are all considered synonyms. Assistance, help, and aid are all considered synonyms of service. Do you think that we performed a service when we fly drone missiles into homes in the Islamic world? Do you think that we are performing a kindness when we invade countries like Iraq and Afghanistan, leading to the deaths of as many as a million people? Is it a good turn when we pull the triggers of our guns and drop our bombs? Is it a helping hand that we are providing when we deploy our military? They say that it's an act of an assistant, that it is also a verb. It is the assistance or advice that is given to customers during or after a sale. It can even be part of a transportation system, providing a transportation service. Well, so what are we supposed to expect? That fighter aircrafts are like passenger planes? That a tank is a mass transport vehicle? I mean, what is it that about the military that would cause anyone to think that it is a service? And I'm going to go through some of America's wars so that this misnomer that the military has provided for Americans' freedom. You know, that the adage that my right to say what I'm saying is somehow derived from the sacrifice of someone who has engaged in war is just absurd. You know, first, this notion that America's military fought in the Revolutionary War is untrue. Most of those who fought in the Revolutionary War were militias. And second of all, they didn't fight for the freedom of Americans. Two out of three Americans opposed the war, and that was before you would count the real Americans, who were the native populations of this country, whom America went to war against before and after the Revolutionary War. But it is a little-known fact that two out of three European who invaders, if you will, or European exports to the Americas, immigrants into the Americas, that two out of every three living in the 13 colonies were opposed to the Revolutionary War. We move from the Revolutionary War to the first of many American Indian wars. The first was fought against the Cherokee, the Shawnee, and the Seminole. Now, since this was their land, the notion that America was protecting freedoms by attacking the native populations is certainly not a service. The next American war, right after the Revolutionary War and the American Indian Wars, was the Barbary Coast Wars. There were several of them. The first was fought off the coast of Morocco. It was against the Ottoman Empire, Islam. Then there was the War of 1812. Now, the War of 1812 was the first example where an American military actually engaged, trying to thwart an invader, in this case, Great Britain. Unfortunately, the only documented battle where the American military actually engaged was when the Brits were pursuing the capital, Washington, D.C., and the American military fled. And the Brits, of course, as we know, burned the capital, including the White House. The victories in the War of 1812 were fought by militias. Then there was the second Barbary War, fought in 1815. It was also against Islam. That war was fought like the first Barbary Coast War to protect American merchant ships. We then have there was no chance that the Muslims were planning on invading America. They were simply pirates. We then have the next installment of the American Indian Wars. This was fought against the Seminole Indians along the East Coast. Next on the list is the Mexican-American War, where America stole Texas, California, Arizona, New Mexico from the Mexican government. It was a war that where the booty was land and property. It is one of the darkest episodes in American history. We provoked the war, and we continued to pursue the war right to the capital of Mexico City, claiming as the spoils all of this enormous territory. And yet America tells Israel that it needs to give back the West Bank and Gaza, as well as the Sinai, when they were the victims of an assault by their enemies and conquered that land only in self-defense, when the Mexican-American War cannot be described as such. Then, of course, there's the Apache War. Most Americans are unaware that that we bombarded Nicaragua and invaded Nicaragua not once but twice. The first was in 1854. That was hardly to protect American freedom. Then there was the Indian Wars in the Puget Sound area, followed by not one but two wars against Fiji. Now, you can tell me why the American military thought that they needed to attack Fiji, but nonetheless we did. Then we fought the Navajo Wars against American natives. Then there was the Second Fiji War in 1858. The Civil War was certainly not to protect American freedoms, because the Civil War was essentially a war fought to keep the Southern nations from freely dissolving from the Union. They freely voted to participate in the union, but according to Lincoln, they could not freely disassociate from the union. So it wasn't to protect freedom, but to deny freedoms. The Indian Wars, again, were fought immediately after the American Civil War. In fact, those who continued on in uniform just simply transitioned from fighting the South to fighting the native populations. They attacked the Dakota, the Sioux, and the Comanche. I happen to be Sioux. Following this was the Spanish-American War. It was fought based upon a lie. The sinking of the Maine is what inspired it, and it sent America as far away as the Philippines. During that time, we also invaded the Korea with the Korean Expedition. And then there was the follow-up invasion of the Philippines, later an occupation of Nicaragua. And then we move on to World War I, where our country was deceived deliberately by Woodrow Wilson, where the a ship which was carrying military apparatus was the Lusitania, was specifically slowed and directed into the teeth of German guns so that the war materials wouldn't arrive in England. It was sunk, and that became a call to arms, and everyone rallied around the flag for the first time. That was the first really rally around the flag war, along with the Spanish-American War. And Americans, duped by their government, signed up to die in trenches, several hundred thousand doing so. As we know, this war, which was fought on behalf of J.P. Morgan and financial interests, then was transitioned into another war, that being what was called World War II, but was actually the First World War. You see, the world is rather Europe egocentric. And so the First War, which is strictly a European skirmish, became known as World War I, even though the First World War was World War II. And look even there. Did Japan or Germany have the means or the desire to invade and occupy America? Is there any case that can be made that the American military fought to protect the American homeland and from invasion and occupation by either foe? The list of American wars goes on and on. The reason I'm sharing this with you is I want to dispel the myth that the American military is the protector of American freedom and that the American military ought to be honored for having prevented nations from invading America and keeping America secure. It is just not true. Not a single one of those wars mentioned previously was, and it could in any way be considered the use of the American military for the purpose of preventing a foreign army from invading America or from occupying America, and therefore there's not a single one of those wars that was fought to keep Americans free. Not one of them. We move on from there, of course, and it just gets worse. We have the Korean War, which had nothing to do with American freedom. We invaded South Korea to keep the North Koreans from invading South Korea, but the North Koreans were equipped by the Chinese, who Americans, our involvement in World War II, had figured that the enemy of our enemy was our friend, and so we allied with Mao Zedong, and his forces and military came to kill us in Korea. This was followed by the Bay of Pigs, Vietnam, of course, where some 50 to 60,000 Americans died, with not a single one of those dying to preserve American freedoms. There isn't a case that can be made that any of those individuals sacrificed their lives for anything worthy. Nothing. There is nothing honorable about it. There was nothing worthy about it. America made a bad situation worse. Now, is it the fault of the boots on the grounds and the men who died? No, I'm not blaming them. I'm just telling you that the nation, political apparatus, and military apparatus deployed Americans and caused many thousands, tens of thousands to die, making a bad situation worse. They did nothing to protect American freedoms. They were not fighting to provide our ability to speak openly and honestly. They weren't protecting America from invasion. We then engaged in Cambodia within the Khmer Rouge Civil War. We then acted in the Congo, again in the Dominican Republic. Then our next war was the secret war that we fought on behalf of and worked with the Taliban and Al-Qaeda to give the Soviets a taste of what they gave us in Vietnam, not admitting that the only reason the Soviets were willing and able to attack Americans through their proxy, the Vietnamese, in Vietnam, killing tens of thousands of our sons, is because that we aided and abetted the Soviet Union in World War II under the misnomer that the enemy of our enemy is our friend. And so we have the first Afghan war. Then we have the invasion of Grenada. And it just continues. We have, you know, the first Gulf War, where we would have been and the world would have been vastly better off had Saddam Hussein invaded and occupied Kuwait and Saudi Arabia, because he was a secularist and the dictating thugs there were religious fundamentalists. And so we would have a great deal less terrorism in the world had Saddam Hussein succeeded, but America decided to fight the secularist and empower the Islamists. And then we invaded, of course, Iraq another time, followed by, preceded by a second war in Afghanistan. Not a single one of these wars preserved American freedom, thwarted an enemy from invading or occupying America. This whole idea that we should support our military because they have provided this service to us is a complete lie. Jefferson, as I have shared on many programs, was overtly opposed to having a military. Jefferson, easily the brightest man to have ever lived in the Americas, said that standing armies were the single greatest threat to a free nation. Let's look at some of his comments. Thomas Jefferson wrote to David Humphreys in 1789, "There are instruments so dangerous to the rights of the nation, and which place them so totally at the mercy of their governors, that those governors, whether legislative or executive, should be restrained from keeping such instruments on foot, but in all but well-defined cases, such an instrument is a standing army." Thomas Jefferson considered a established military the single greatest and most dangerous threat to the rights and freedoms of a nation. When we return to Shattering Myths, I will share with you why Thomas Jefferson did not like the U.S. Constitution, why he did not sign it, and why you should be concerned about what we have become. We'll return to Shattering Myths in a moment. We are considering the statements of Thomas Jefferson regarding a standing military. He was overtly opposed to it. It's kind of interesting. Today I was watching the news, and there's a military, not so much military as it is ROTC, but ROTC is training to be military, and they're supervised by military officers. But the ROTC at the University of Virginia, which is Thomas Jefferson's university, is they're on a 24-hour march in front of the rotunda, which was Jefferson, the first building that Jefferson built at the University of Virginia. The University of Virginia is Thomas Jefferson's university, and here you have a military march in honor of Veterans Day, when Thomas Jefferson was opposed to an established military. This is something that Jefferson wrote to his neighbor, James Madison. James Madison lived in Orange County. Thomas Jefferson lived in Albemarle County. They are adjacent counties. This is was written in 1787. He says, "I do not like in the new federal constitution the omission of a Bill of Rights providing clearly and without aid of sophisms for protection against standing armies, end quote. Well, the reason that Thomas Jefferson didn't sign the Declaration of Independence, the reason that Thomas Jefferson isn't seen, not Declaration of Independence, the U.S. Federal Constitution, isn't seen as an advocate of the U.S. Constitution, is because in the Bill of Rights there was not a designation protecting the nation against an established military. He then wrote, and this was Thomas Jefferson in his first annual message, nor is it conceived needful or safe that a standing army, this would be an established military, should be kept in a time of peace. He would write in 1775 in a reply to Lord North's proposition, standing armies, an established military, is inconsistent with a people's freedoms and subversive of their quiet. He would then say in 1807, the spirit of this country is adverse to a large military force. This was Thomas Jefferson in his letter to Chandler Price. A distinction between civil and military is one which it should be for the good of the whole to obliterate as soon as possible. What Thomas Jefferson was writing here is that his view is that the reason that the Bill of Rights contains language about never interfering with an individual's right to keep or bear arms is that he said that literally a militia was absolutely necessary to the freedom of a country. And so Thomas Jefferson viewed that the protection of a country from invasion should be handled by individual citizens who are armed. And even today, it's still the best defense. If America honored the Second Amendment and Americans were allowed without any restraint to own whatever weapons that they chose to own, the very fact of having so many Americans armed with the appropriate weaponry would make it impossible for any nation anywhere on earth to invade and occupy America. It is impossible. That was our protection against freedom. And the last thing Jefferson wanted to see us doing is projecting our force and becoming an imperialist nation. So he recognized that there should be no distinction between military and civilians. He was right. If today America was willing to completely eliminate its military and save $750 billion a year, plus not be in a position where it squanders $4 to $6 trillion on wasted counterproductive invasions like Afghanistan and Iraq, the nation would be vastly more secure than it is squandering this money. And motivated as we are to use our drones and to use our ability to protect a force. Jefferson answers to Jean Basté, Messeigneur, in his questions in 1786. This is to Monet, so Jean Baptiste Monet. A letters which he also cc'd Madison. He wrote something that we have covered on this show twice in the past, but I want to repeat it because it is amongst the most profound bit of prose that I have ever encountered. Jefferson wrote, "Of all of the enemies to public liberty, war is perhaps the most to be dreaded, because it comprises and develops the germ of every other. War is the parent of armies. From these proceed debts and taxes, and armies and debts and taxes are the known instruments for bringing the many under the dominion of the few. In war, too, the discretionary power of the executive is extended. Its influence in dealing out offices, honors, and emoluments is multiplied. And all the means of seducing the minds are added to those of subduing the force of the people. The same malignant aspect in republicanism can be traced in the inequality of fortunes and the opportunities for fraud growing out of a state of war, and in the degeneracy of manners and morals endangered by both. No nation can preserve its freedom in the midst of continual war. And yet America has engaged in a war on average every 4 years and has since its inception. We are a nation of endless wars. We're a nation whose military is larger than the rest of the world's combined. Jefferson was right. We are wrong. We have Dwight Davidson from calling in from Dallas. Sorry for mentioning your name, Dwight. Try to be more anonymous than that. So my brain must be taking the day off. I apologize for that, but I understand that you have a question.
Sir, it's not concerning what you're talking about now.
That's okay, Dwight.
Have you uploaded your latest revision of Questioning Power to the website?
You know, I have provided it, and I understand through a meeting I had yesterday that that the work to get the revision of Questioning Paul to questioningpaul.com was about 80% complete. I don't know if it is totally complete, but I'll tell you what I will do for you. And it will be in the next 3 or 4 days, I'm pretty assured of that, but what I will do for you, if you will send me an email at email just at the contact us at the Yada Ya website. If you go to yadaya.com, on that website, there's a contact us feature. If you send me an email, I will send you a link to a site that has all of the revision of Questioning Paul, both up in HTML and PDF, but also in an audio form. Really outstanding site. So I will send that to you. So that you know, the revision of Questioning Paul was a year-long project. I devoted, you know, 6 hours a day, to 6 hours a day because I do the radio show and the other time, 6 days a week to improving Questioning Paul. Questioning Paul is a book I wrote 4 or 5 years ago when a friend of mine from New Zealand told me that that Christian radio stations there were promoting the notion that Paul annulled the Torah and that the Torah no longer had any value, and that because Paul annulled the Torah, it should be completely discounted, that it no longer had any influence on our lives and was, in fact, counterproductive. They were preaching from Galatians and said the Torah was incapable of saving anyone. And so he said, this is obviously inconsistent with God's testimony. Can you look into Galatians and based upon a study of it, let me know, was Paul misquoted? Did Paul, was Paul misinterpreted? Or did Paul actually say these things? And so I devoted about a little over a year and a half to writing the first version of Questioning Paul. It was published about 3 years ago. And then I've learned so much since that time. And I'm not one of these guys, that Dwight, who is willing to say that I am always right. I'm willing to tell you that I make a lot of mistakes and I'm constantly learning. And when you learn, you find that, you know, there's things I need to improve on. And Questioning Paul was one of them. And so I set out to improve the book, to improve the translations, to include more translations should mine not be favored, should somebody want another translation other than my own. So I made 4 translations or 5 available for each statement. And then I vastly improved the amount of information that was brought to bear in the debate as to whether or not Paul was a false prophet. And I think you mentioned in your comments to my producer that you were interested in the translations of Habakkuk. In the rewrite of Questioning Paul, Dwight, Habakkuk forms the backbone of the rewrite. Because in the first version, I approached the first version of it by saying, you know, this argument is being made that Paul contradicted God, claiming to speak for God, that he contradicted God. And so we're going to investigate the evidence and see where it leads us. And so the first four or five chapters were written trying to give Paul the benefit of the doubt, and they finally came to the place where Paul had created a second covenant and said that the covenant that is enshrined in the Torah on Mount Sinai enslaved. And since there's only one covenant, and since God says that the purpose of that covenant is to liberate us, Paul's position was the opposite of Yahweh's, and they could not be reconciled. And so from that point on, I just provided the weight of evidence to prove that Paul was a false prophet.
Right.
And the evidence all came from Yahweh or Yahusha. It was Yahweh, Yahusha versus Paul. As I was rewriting Questioning Paul, Dwight, this may be more information than you were interested in with your call, but you know, there may be others that will benefit from me sharing this, so I'm going to continue here. As I was rewriting Questioning Paul, I had many people that I've come to know online assist. And what I asked at least 20 people to do, of which many participated, was to search the existing version to see, is there anything that I said that was errant, misleading, incomplete, that could be better communicated, more effectively researched and documented, and what did I miss that I should also share? And one of them said, read and translate Habakkuk. I had Dallas regarding Questioning Paul and the revision of Questioning Paul. I did find that URL, that website address for you, Dwight. So if you or anyone wants to write it down, or you can listen to the archives of the show to make certain that you have it. But it begins YHWH. YHWH happens to be the four letters that comprise Yahweh's name. YHWH. Then a dash or a hyphen, you know, the straight dash or a hyphen, not an underline, but a dash or a hyphen. QRA.com. So YHWH-QRA.com. QRA is short for Kara, which is an invitation to meet with Yahweh, which is what the website is named after. It was done by a longtime friend of mine and a really good guy. It's a marvelous site. It has the most recent version of Questioning Paul, both in written and audio form. Dwight, the thing that you were particularly after is the translations and insights available on Habakkuk. One of the most transforming events of my life was a friend of mine suggesting that I look at one of the statements in Habakkuk 2 and translate it and see if, in fact, it was addressing Paul. And the reason it was so transforming is that by analyzing Paul's testimony, particularly his first letter, the letter to the Galatians, against Yahusha's statements and Yahweh's statements, it was obvious that Paul was adverse to Yahweh and was in open opposition to God, and that it is rationally impossible that someone who claims to be inspired and to be speaking for someone can consistently contradict that individual. And so it was obvious to me that Paul lied. But it's one thing for me to do the work and to say, okay, here's what Yahusha said about the Torah, here's what Paul said about the Torah, they're opposites. It's another thing entirely to have had God through a prophet 666 years before Paul wrote Galatians, his first letter, tell us emphatically what this man would be like and name him by name. And Habakkuk specifically says that Shaul, Paul's name, Shaul, is the plague of death. And it addresses his outreach to Gentiles. It addresses his intoxicating circular reasoning. It addresses his gargantuan ego. It addresses the fact that he was engaged in treacherous betrayal. It goes on and on to describe everything that Paul did, including this notion of proclaiming this myth that God died, and that God's death was somehow a means to salvation. God can't die. And so this prophecy even goes as far, Dwight, to say that the perpetrator, who is always a singular masculine individual, that the perpetrator, who the prophet, who through the prophet Yahweh names as Shaul, Paul, he says that his offense will take place during the Moed. The first four Moed, or the Moed Mikra, were fulfilled in 33 CE, and Paul was a witness to them. And then it said that the testimony, the understanding of this prophecy, will be relevant during the last days. That's when it will be understood, and that's where we are now. And so as I read this and saw God's deliberately providing us absolute proof that the founder of the Christian religion, the author of half of the Christian New Testament, Paul, was the plague of death. I mean, it was a profoundly affirming an invigorating, enlightening bit of testimony. And so I'm glad that you're interested in studying it and reading it and investigating it. We have today more than 2 billion people that have been deceived, alive today, that have been deceived by Paul, who will die as a result of trusting this man's religious faith. And God's not the least bit humored by it. So that's a long explanation of it, Dwight. You'll find it at yhwh-qra.com, and very soon, I would imagine within days, at questioningpaul.com. Does that answer your question, Dwight, or do you have another?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Go ahead.
What document did you use to reinterpret it? When I read it, I'm not getting anything about Shaul.
Okay. I read it directly out of the Masoretic text, and I compared the Masoretic text to the Dead Sea Scrolls and corrected the Masoretic to the Dead Sea Scrolls. I will explain when we get back why you're not reading Shaul, and I am.